Hi. I got a tape I want to play.
Everybody,
you're great because you're about to leave the country, so
I'm feeling anxiety about it,
right? Jealous. LADCC nominations came out, the LA Drama Critics Awards,
very
and
exciting.
How We Got On, which I produced at Sacred Fools last year, just a year ago, was nominated for Best Composition, Best Music Composition.
Sean
Kantowitz. Awesome. So thrilled for that. Ben Morawski was a nominee of ours at Fringe last year.
Mm-hmm.
Also got a big nom.
That's right.
For two noms, Best Solo Performance and Best Playwriting. Is that right, Bales?
I think that's right. He's like up against, like, for performance, he's up against Holland Taylor and Anne.
He's
going to
beat her. Come on.
He might.
So what you're saying is
physically?
Up against the inheritance.
No, not physically.
So what you're saying is theater should become the official podcast of the LADCCs.
I heard it. I heard that.
I didn't say that, but I'll take it.
I mean, tastemakers is what I am hearing.
Tastemakers, yeah. We're dialed in.
So theater goes, so does the theater scene in LA.
Yeah, yes. We're dialed in, for sure.
Yep, we're a big deal. We host an award at Fringe.
Fringe.
Whoa! Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty big deal.
Theater Christmas.
Movers and shakers.
If you're the taste makers, who are the moist makers?
That's a whole different. That's a whole different podcast series right there.
It's
a whole different series.
Speaking of theater, welcome to Theater, the theater podcast for theater nerds, made by three theater makers from the LA theater scene. I'm Jay Bailey Burcham.
I'm CJ Merriman.
And I am Scott Leggett.
That's right. And each week we get together to discuss and debate the definition of theater through various lenses. And this week is a Scott's pick.
I chose Talking Heads Stop Making Sense for a variety of reasons. It's an insanely amazing concert movie, but it's also got a lot of theatricality and theater elements that I thought would be cool to talk about.
Yes. Absolutely. And technically, this is part one of a two-part miniseries because we're also going to do American Utopia later in the season.
Mm-hmm. Spoiler alert. Yeah.
Spoiler alert. But we are joined with some friends this week, which I'm super fucking pumped about. We have here with us past and future guest, a Los Angeles local playwright, actress, comedian. Mm. You may remember her from Paula Vogel miniseries, season one or two or something like that. I think that's two. Natalie Nicole Dressel.
Yeah.
Hey.
Glad to be back. Friend of the podcast.
Yes. And then we also have local director and badass stage manager Jay Dutcher here with us. They just happen to be romantic partners and dear friends of us all. So no infighting here. No fighting.
No.
Oh, we never fight.
We don't put our dirty laundry in the paint.
We don't fight. We have a perfect relationship.
Yes.
Never fight
once, and then we got it out of our system.
It's all done.
But welcome, Nat and Jay. We're so glad to have you here.
Thank you. Pleasure
to be here.
Good to see you all. And are we doing pronouns on this?
Sure, go for it.
Minor she, him. That's it.
No,
and minor she, her.
this is something that we sort of have talked to y'all about like 500 times, which is why we thought of you for the episode. I just feel like we've been outside of the bar and it's come up almost every time.
Yeah, we talk about it frequently. It's, yeah.
I remember distinctly us all getting high and having a Zoom hangout during lockdown,
during
which is right as American Utopia came out. And then it was like this, have you seen American Utopia? Have you seen Stop Making Sense? Oh my God. Like it was just like nerds going crazy. I love it.
I listened to American Utopia for like 3 months straight after I saw it. It was my work. Like I would listen to it at work and my Spotify Wrapped was really weird. It always is because of my work listening, but I was kind of glad it was American Utopia. Talking Heads are great.
Yeah.
Mine is often Yeba. Anyway, my top listen. But I want to hear a little bit before I hand it off fully to Scott, because it was his choice. And I went ham on the Hairspray episode. I re-listened and I was like, oh my God, Bailey, shut the fuck up. But it was my episode.
Your episode.
So it was my episode.
Yeah, I went ham. Totally.
But it was fun. But this time I'm going to pass it off, but I want to hear everybody's sort of context with Stop Making Sense. I want to know like how you were introduced to it and what your relationship is with it. I know we all love it, but I'll go first because mine's very simple. I watched it for the first time in the lockdown when Blank Check with Griffin and David, the podcast, was doing a Jonathan Demme watch through.
Nice.
Called Stop Making Podcasts.
Uh-huh.
We stole that bit from them, that the titles are podcast.
Yes,
we put podcast in the title, just so everyone is very clear. We're basically
homage,
a sister podcast that they don't know about. We're
yes.
like a bastard sister. But that's okay. I still love us. But I watched it, loved it, and then started listening to the Talking Heads. I knew who they were. I knew who David Byrne was, but I hadn't really engaged with them. And now I have. Really sad that I hadn't done it earlier in my life. That's all. Hey, I'm going to zoom it over to Natalie. Why not?
Oh, okay. I too didn't really take a deep dive into the Talking Heads until the lockdown. For me, it was a podcast that I listened to that stars Scott Aukerman and Adam Scott, which is called Are You Talking Heads to My Talking Head? which
Shout
is
out.
Part of their continuing series where they talk about bands that started with Are You Talking You Two to Me? Which they're brilliant and they're mostly nonsense and then sometimes get around to the topics at hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that combined with seeing American Utopia when it came out, I think I saw Stop Making Sense after that.
Mm-hmm.
Me and Jay's roommate was actually super into Talking Heads and was like all too happy to give us like a full lecture on it. And at the time, he was doing this thing because he saw a Nintendo Direct where the head of Nintendo has two TVs so that he can watch movies and play video games at the same time. So something we started doing was watching side-by-side movies at the same time to see how
Whoa.
They linked up.
Ah. And
we watched Stop Making Sense at the same time as American Utopia. And what you do is you sort of like modulate the volume of like here where your focus is going to be. And sometimes it would be like he was looking at himself in the past or the future, singing to himself. And there was something
cool.
really powerful about seeing it as like one piece.
That's interesting.
Hell yeah.
That's interesting.
That's fun.
Yes.
Pass it off, Nat. Who's next?
I'll pass it off to CJ.
Well, I had absolutely no context with the Talking Heads or either of the movies we watched on Friday because we did get an American Utopia as well. And we've discussed this on the podcast before because I know I've had each and every one of you and other people say like, oh, stop making sense. You've got to see it. You've got to see it. And we've discussed on the podcast before that gets tricky when people are constantly telling you it's the best. You'll love it. You'll love it. You'll love it.
Hype absolutely kills.
And it did. I mean, it was also one of those things where as I was listening to it, I was like, oh, I know this song. Oh, I know this song, of course. But I watched it with y'all on Friday and loved it. I watched it again last night and loved it. And I've listened to the album maybe two times through since then. So, like, I am a Talking Heads fan. I really loved this film. And I've told a bunch of people about it since we watched it. So, thanks, y'all. That was great.
Yeah,
Fred and the Talking Heads love.
You're up, Jay.
Me? Okay. Mine is basically the same as Natalie's. It's very, very similar. I was familiar with Talking Heads. I knew about like Psycho Killer and Bringing Down the House and, you know, the standards. I think I did have a moment while I was watching Stop Talking Heads where I was like, oh, this is a Talking Heads song, and then realized just how many there were.
Mm-hmm.
But I basically just started watching it in quarantine with Natalie and my roommate. We were all together watching it. Shout out to Ian.
Ian!
Future guest.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, God, yeah.
And I just have the added context of, like, my dad and I were, like, big music heads when I was a kid. Mm. And I'm surprised that he never brought up Talking Heads, but I feel like it was because we just didn't get the time to. Like, he passed away when I was 16. Mm. So, like, I feel like 17 was the year he was going to talk to me about Talking Heads.
Uh-huh. Right.
And that didn't happen, so I had to wait, like, 15 years.
Yeah.
And now I love them. Yes. So. Yes.
Right on.
Shout out to my dad.
Yes.
Fiverr.
Right.
Guys.
Nice. All right. So I'm older than all of you.
What?
Yes. I remember being a very small child, and I remember Siskel and Ebert reviewing this movie.
Yeah.
And they were both blown away. And I remember at the time having the sense that when they're excited and they give two thumbs up, that's worth seeing.
Sure.
And they were just astounded by the output of energy from it. And so being a kid of that time period, the Talking Heads were kind of always around. They were big on MTV, you know, the Once in a Lifetime video with the big suit and sure. David Byrne and that. And they were sort of always omnipresent, although I didn't get into them until after their breakup. So early 90s. And I remember Kurt Loder on MTV News breaking in with the news that the Talking Heads had disbanded. And I was like, oh, maybe now's the time to go. And I think there's a reoccurring theme here. And I've heard it from a lot of people that have discovered the Talking Heads later, in life or in current times. But, it's this thing with, oh, I didn't know that was a Talking Heads song. Mm-hmm. Oh, I didn't know this thing. Because they were just unlike any other band. They had a few hits, but they didn't have a lot of hits. Their stuff sort of started creeping into the zeitgeist and into pop culture as people started using their songs for soundtracks and that kind of thing. And that's where people kind of got it put in their brains. Burning Down the House is in Revenge of the Nerds, the movie. So like, and I remember hearing, oh, what's that song? And then, of course, it was Talking Heads. So, and then I just sort of, they're a band that I keep coming back to, at least a couple times a year. I will start listening to the catalog, and it's usually while I'm doing housework or folding laundry. But they're just, they are unlike anything else. You can hear where their influences were and that sort of thing, but nobody else sounded like them. Nobody tried to copy them. They were so unique. It was like people were kind of afraid of them.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that was my intro.
You know how some people wait until Game of Thrones was completely over to start watching Game of Thrones?
Yeah.
Right. That's what you did with Talking Heads.
That was kind of it. All right. Yeah.
But like that, now I can just binge it.
Right.
Yes.
And I was also older. I mean, by that point, I'm in middle school going into high school. And so I could start getting it beyond, the imagery of the videos and him as a person, as a caricature, and really get into the lyrics and the music itself.
Yes. So I officially pass the baton. Scott, it's yours. because we have something that we like to do, mm-hmm. so that we get ourselves a little bit more introduced to our topic. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What's that called again?
Scottpedia. Scottpedia.
Woo!
Right. That's right. I like that stinger.
Yeah, it's a good stinger. Thank you, Ryan Thomas Johnson. So what I did here is I'm going to do a quick thing on the Talking Heads, and I'm going to do a quick thing on Jonathan Demme, and then we can segue into that, because those are the two entities that are involved in this particular film. So the Talking Heads, I love Wikipedia, the Talking Heads were an American rock band. It's like the last thing I would call the Talking Heads is a rock band. They formed in 1975 in New York City. The band was composed of Scottish-born David Byrne, on lead vocals and guitar, Chris France on drums, Tina Weymouth on bass, and Jerry Harrison was on keyboards and guitar. Described as one of the most critically acclaimed bands of the 1980s, Talking Heads helped pioneer new wave music, and they are the reason that the term new wave music exists.
Oh, cool.
Because they were part of the
whole... Because of the waves in David Byrne's hair, and yes. he played music.
Yes,
they were so new.
They were so new. But they were lumped in with the punk scene. And so their record executive, upon signing them, was like, I need to distance them from punk a little bit. And so he literally made a press statement that said, there's a whole new wave of New York music that you need to hear. And that started the whole thing. Anyway, their music incorporates elements of punk, art rock, funk, and world music with an anxious, clean-cut image. Byrne, France, and Weymouth met as freshman students at the Rhode Island School of Design. Art school kids, you know that they're always going to be a problem. They moved to New York City in 1975, and they joined the scene, playing a lot at CBGBs along with groups like Blondie and the Ramones. There are bills that were nights where the Talking Heads would open, they would be followed by Blondie, and then the Ramones would finish. It's like, how eclectic is that? And
that's awesome. Pretty sick. Right? Do you think David Byrne ever kicked it with Patti Smith?
Oh, I'm sure. Like they were tight groups of folks, but that would be
A good play.
write that down.
What would that conversation sound like?
Oh man, I don't know. There'd be a lot of staring at the floor, and then slowly they would come into they were both do that.
I like your stuff.
Yeah,
I like your stuff.
Your stuff's really cool. I like your stuff.
I wish I could do stuff as cool as your stuff. No, your stuff is cool.
Yeah.
We'll have Carol Churchill write it.
Right. But Tina Weymouth and Chris Franz started dating and eventually got married and are still married, as I found out recently. Since 1977. But originally, Tina was just the van driver for the band.
Hot.
After they couldn't find a bass player, basically they Chris asked her to learn how to play bass and join the band. So she learned how to play bass and joined the band.
And she's fucking
okay,
awesome.
Honey. She's the best.
She's like a genius. Yeah. And then later, Chris Harrison had been around the whole scene and was an accomplished and had recorded several albums with other bands. So they snagged him up and they basically recorded their first four albums in under 3 years from 1976 through 81. They took a break. Then they started to tour extensively, which is where they shot this. And then they broke up in 91 and only performed one more time together. And that was at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony. There is a lot of bad blood between Byrne and the other members of the band.
Oh, no.
Yeah, they don't get along. There was lawsuits. He basically just said, I'm leaving the band. I'm done. And the others were like, well, we're going to keep going. And they renamed themselves just The Heads, I think. Mm-hmm. And they recorded an album as The Heads, and then David Byrne sued them, going, "No, you can't do that." Yeah, it was bad. Yeah. But moving on from the band, let's talk real quick about Robert Jonathan Demme. Who's the director of this film and does an extraordinary job. Yeah. Born in 1944, died in 2017. His death was kind of sudden and he was way too young. But he started out in the 70s as a B-movie producer under the tutelage of Roger Corman.
Yep.
His first directing gig was the 1974 Women in Prison film, Caged Heat, which is a cult classic. If you have never seen it, watch Caged Heat.
I have never seen it.
Oh my God. It is worth it.
Take. It's good.
It's really good. And it holds up.
It's not really good.
It's not really good. But as a cult classic, as a cult classic weird thing, it's great. He then went on to have really one of the most eclectic careers in Hollywood as a Hollywood filmmaker. Yeah. He does Melvin and Howard in 1980, which is a fantastic flick. Jason Robards as Howard Hughes. It's marvelous. What's her name? Won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress for that. I can't remember her name. But then he did Swing Shift. He did Something Wild. He did Married to the Mob. Then he did Silence of the Lambs.
For which he wins Best Director.
For which he wins Best Director. He does Philadelphia. He does Rachel Getting Married. And in addition to Stop Making Sense, he directed all kinds of other concert movies for Neil Young, Justin Timberlake. And to just bring it all back to theater, we were talking off mic about Spalding Gray's Swimming to Cambodia, which is a fantastic, really well-filmed live performance of a dude just doing monologues. So, yeah. Bales, you were going to jump in. What you want to
do?
No,
you did it all. It's cool.
Did I cover it all? Did I step on your toes?
Well. It's all good. I was just going to talk about his films, Demi. I'm just a huge Jonathan Demme fan, and I really love... Like, you know, you missed a few of his films. No big deal. Sure. It's okay.
No. Totally
the remake of The Manchurian Candidate.
My word.
Right, yes.
Remake of The Manchurian Candidate is absolutely
Trouble
phenomenal.
In Paradise.
Mr. Builder.
Who would have thought when talking about The Manchurian Candidate, like, you just say the wrong thing and just someone kind of activates the app, you know?
What?
Manchurian Candidate remake, Master Builder, which is a... Henrik Ibsen piece.
That's right.
Oh, yeah,
that's right. I forgot about that.
And then starring Wallace fucking Shawn.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's put some respect on Master Builder real quick.
Yeah.
Oh, I think I've read that play.
Good play.
It's a good play.
Fine play. Great movie.
Yeah. I've never seen the movie, so.
It's fine. I think it's called A Master Builder, and the play is called The Master Builder, or it's like the other way around. It's something like that. But. He does all of these studio films, like concert films, like you say. But his final film is the Justin Timberlake and the Tennessee Kids film. And it's a little sad.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a little depressing. That's like his final major, like theatrical release.
Yeah. But what
but
a
swimming
career!
To Cambodia is a big with Spalding Gray is like a huge, huge.
Yeah, I mean, that's the all. Desk is its own character.
The desk is its own character in that. Yeah.
I ship them.
You ship Spalding Gray and the desk?
Yeah, I ship them. That's my OTP.
I love it. To get back to the movie and to talk about the movie, and one of the things that popped into my head and one of the reasons I suggested doing this was I had just finished a reread of The Empty Space. By Peter Brook. And I was intrigued because one of the first things I thought about was Stop Making Sense. I'm like, they start with nothing. He starts with nothing, and you add only when you need to add
at
to
at the Pantages,
it.
No less, y'all.
At the
Pantages. LA theater.
LA, yeah. And so that building of, and then learning more about Byrne and what things he had been influenced by. He had gone to Japan and he'd seen Kabuki and Bunraku and No Theater and was intrigued by the costumes and the size of the costumes and how that brought emphasis to the head. And then this movie starts and it's such a simple thing. And then it just keeps going and it just keeps building. And it just knocked me on my ass the first time I saw it. And like it was really cool to watch CJ, who'd never seen it, watch it the other night and just kind of go, oh my God, like the background singers and all of them are just extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
What's your favorite parts about this?
There's so Many. I'm curious about the Keds budget for this film. I mean, yeah, I loved the backup
Talking
singers,
Keds.
But I had, I mean, I just had so many. There are now songs that I'd never heard before that I now love and have listened to over and over again. But there's also just shit too about like, oh, it's in the second part of the concert where, and I can't remember the name of the song right now, but it's where it's all uplighting on everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the way I just wonder like how much rehearsal went into this, how much of this was planned. Did they know that they had light like that, that they could use it that way? Because while it's a film, it's like you're sitting in the theater with them.
Well, they
and like some of it seems so choreographed, and then sometimes it seems like they're just kind of playing off of each other. And I don't know where that begins and where that ends. And I loved that about it too.
Yeah.
I think that just came from constant performing. They start performing together in clubs in 75 and basically go on a 6 or 7 year run of nonstop performing. And then as the music evolved and becomes more complicated, and they add the insane backup band to them, you know, and they all look like they're having a fucking blast.
Yeah.
Like, that's thing. The joy that's coming out of all of them is amazing.
I have such FOMO. Just, when I'm watching that, I'm like, oh, I wish I was there.
Right.
Yeah. I would settle with just being in the audience.
Right.
Well, and the thing I watching this and then also American Utopia and learning a little bit about David Byrne and everything, I watched it and walked away from both of the films thinking, I only want to do shit that matters for the rest of my life.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like shit that, not necessarily like famous or anything, but stuff that means something, that says something, that's daring. And yeah, it just was really inspiring to watch.
For sure. Yeah, I think that one of the things that I also sort of dial in on is his exuberance and then the building of that exuberance from everybody else. Everybody else's cocaine. Contribution to it. Well, yeah, you know, I ain't mad if everybody's doing a few bumps backstage before the show. Right on.
What in the 80s wasn't fueled? What in the 80s wasn't fueled by cocaine?
Right, you know.
That's a fair and true question.
I just don't know how they did that cocaine and then went on stage and were actually able to sing.
Practice.
Yes, right. Practice. We did discuss that while watching.
Yeah. You practice on coke, you can perform on coke.
Right. But yeah, I guess
it's sort of like if you study high, then you can do the test high. Yeah.
Yeah.
I swear to God, I knew all of this, Mr. Johnson. I knew it all last night.
Fair, fair.
But to go back to CJ's point about the shooting of it and being at the Pantages and all that, they shot it over 3 nights and edited it together. But there was a point where Demi really wanted to try and get the audience shots in, and that wasn't working. And then he wanted to get a little bit more intimate with a few shots. So they actually performed on a soundstage that they made up to look like the Pantages.
They actually didn't do that. They didn't do it. The band ended up vetoing it. They started to do it, and the band came out and was like, we don't want that. So they shot things at the Pantages that without the band. Like the band
Yeah, they said they started and they were like, this is the worst Talking Heads performance ever. We can't do this. Like,
no audience. We're not going
to
do
We need
it.
To do and this in like, front of an audience.
Oh, okay.
But I think that one of the brilliant strokes about the movie too is that you don't see the audience at all. Like so many concert movies cut to the audience and, you know, you see people screaming. You don't see anybody till the very end.
Such a triumphant moment when you realize, oh shit, audience.
Yeah, you know, and they're having a blast, you know, they're in it. But
there's a lot of shots where you see silhouettes of the audience, where it's like you sort of have a far back shot. So it's not necessarily like the story of a band and its audience. It's a band and like you are the audience.
Right.
I feel like I'd have a harder time putting myself, like imagining that I'm seeing a theater piece if I see the audience. Like, I feel like it's like a surrogacy or something. Like, I feel like what's of an audience is going to help me put my point of view with them.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I actually have a question about the audience. Am I wrong in thinking that, like, building the band up and building the set behind them and all of that stuff as the show goes on, the audience fills in as the show goes on, right? Because at the top, it seems like there's only like 30 or 50 people in the audience.
No, they're all there.
They're all there? Okay.
They're just not showing you.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, it's a full audience. It's three different nights of completely stacked houses, all three, you know, it's multiple layers. And it's pretty cool because they also didn't put the cameras in the same place all three nights, which is really interesting for editing purposes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's, they had like the first night they shot it all from the front angle, and then the second night all from the left, and third night all from the right, or whatever it may be. But it's kind of interesting. I thought about that. I was like, for editing, that sounds like a nightmare.
Yes.
But also makes it really dynamic. I think that adds to it in a certain way.
Yeah.
Where it's like, I don't know, it's pretty cool.
No, and I think
it's also so choreographed, it's probably easier to edit because they're all
they're
that was my second question is like, how much is improvised each night? How I'm curious about how like regimented it is, how much improv there is. And
I mean, based on what I know about Byrne and probably how he went about the start of that tour was probably pretty mapped out and choreographed, you know, at least in terms of the background singers and the other musicians down on the floor, the other guitar player and Tina and all that, because they're all kind of doing choreography. But it feels like that by the time what we're seeing is an evolution of a tour that had already been going on for 2 years.
Mm.
They just knew how to snap into the vibe. And so you get that. It does. It doesn't feel choreographed, but it is choreographed, and it's really just remarkable. Like, I can't think of any other performances by bands, and I've seen a lot of bands over the years that move like that. Where the show is shaped the way it is, and I think that's, you know, Byrne's, you know, obsession with theatrics and, you know, art and multimedia too, which is a whole nother thing. You have all the projections that start coming in later on that hadn't really been done before.
Props.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, and the costume changes and all that, but the practical, the lamps,
practicals. We yelled about, and spike marks. That was the other thing I loved about this.
Well, and the crew too, you know, there's something that's, you know, almost Brechtian about, we're not going to try and hide the crew, you know.
No, I love it.
Let them pull out and then, you know, push out the platforms and all that. And then bringing them out at the end and introducing the crew. This is our
stage crew. They were a character, you know, so
they were
the desk and swimming to Cambodia.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But yeah, I think
they were L.A. and La La Land.
Yeah, it's totally a character unto itself. You know, I've always said that.
At least today you just said it.
Yeah, I stand.
I also think that the other thing that Demi does so well is that he stays out of it. Like, there's no mark of Jonathan Demme on it. His work is about the band and the performance. There's no signature Jonathan Demme thing that he's doing. He's focused on that performance and putting it
to really anyway. When you start putting his films up against each other, you're a little bit like,
yeah, I mean, I guess
these
what
were
is
made by the same person.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's so eclectic. It's so all over the place.
He does like really pushed in, you know, oners of like someone's face, and they give like a whole monologue. He does that a lot in Silence of the Lambs. I think there's a bit of that in Philadelphia and like some
of
the later
stuff.
Yeah,
a lot of that. Yeah.
Knock at the Cabin. Have y'all seen Knock at the Cabin?
Yes.
Yet? Does that like a ton, and I kept being like, oh, is this gonna be like sort of a Silence reference, is this sort of, it's not, but it's a good choice. It was an interesting movie. We'll talk about it some other time when we're not discussing this amazing film.
Yeah, what next, what else do we got?
I think they got a lot of steps during the show.
They got their steps in. Their cocaine steps. Like, how many calories did he burn? Like, just running around the perimeter like that.
Yeah. David Byrne reminds me of, like, four men that I know, and two of them are ex-boyfriends. Like, I was really kind of hot for him the whole time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, sure. We kept talking about how... I'm a neck person, like, yes. Really do it for me. Uh-huh. Necks and shoulders, and there was a lot of David Byrne neck action. I mean everybody on that stage is beautiful, so
oh my god,
they're all beautiful. It's the same in American Utopia, honestly. It's a theme.
Oh yeah.
It's a theme. But like
hot people.
Everybody looks great. Tina looks so great in her jumpsuit. Mm-hmm. As the drummer is Chris, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's his name.
Yeah.
In his bright turquoise shirt. He does an interview on Are You Talking? Talking Heads to My Talking Head with Scott, and he talks about how he just forgot to bring his correct costume item that day. So he just had this bright turquoise polo shirt, which I think is hilarious. Like, I don't know. I feel like David Byrne was probably a little bristly about that.
His
vision.
Sure.
I actually think it looks good. Like, it's kind of like, oh, look at that. You can clearly see the drummer, you know?
The thing that makes me laugh about that too is, like, they're this world-renowned band. They've been together 9 years. It's this film that they're doing. They're on Hollywood Boulevard in Los Angeles. Somebody couldn't have just said, like, hey, go get him another t-shirt.
Yeah,
they totally could have. Absolutely. Absolutely.
They could have gotten him like a gray t-shirt for this, like, thousands of souvenir shops on
it's
Hollywood.
All you need, turn it inside out.
In drummers, this traffic, the drummer, there's nowhere to park.
That's a really good point.
Take your pets down the street. Go to a souvenir shop.
Yeah, the drummers get to wear whatever they want, though. The drummers, they're stuck in. They can't go nowhere.
Leave drummers alone.
Okay? Leave drummers alone. Hey, we should give a shout out to those backup bands. So all of the backups folks. Yeah. So the backing singers are Lynn Mabry and Edna Holt.
They were my favorite.
Amazing. Oh my god, they were and how dialed they were to him.
Yeah.
And to the whole band, like, they are dialed in.
They were so good.
It just seemed like they were just going back and forth, having a good time. Like, it seemed like we were a part of their conversation and party.
Yeah.
Yes.
Two and David Byrne in particular.
Oh yeah.
I felt a bit like when we were watching American Utopia, I was missing them a bit. And the two, like, dancer background people for that were great too.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I don't know.
It's just different.
It's a vibe. Yeah, different vibe.
They have something special.
But I know what you mean. Special. Yeah, it was kind of missing from American Utopia. I see what you mean. Yeah. I agree.
Do you think the girl singers from School of Rock, the movie, are referencing the singers from Stop Making Sense?
Oh, maybe. Oh,
I haven't seen School of Rock in an age, so... Yeah.
I mean, it's
basically,
you know, it's so ubiquitous in terms of, you know, rock folks knowing it. You know, Documentary Now did their spoof on Stop Making Sense. So, yeah.
We'll be covering School of Rock in about 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Yes, oh, the Andrew Lloyd Webber one, right?
Yeah.
Can't wait.
I can. No. Also, shout out to guitarist Alex Weir, keyboardist Bernie Worrell, who was a member of Parliament Funkadelic, which was a huge influence on the Talking Heads and Byrne in particular. And then percussionist Steve Scales, just extraordinary, just having a blast, tight as can be. Like, I've seen bad concerts by acclaimed bands that were just like, you guys, have you ever played together before? And like, these people have played together. REM, by the way, was the band that that horrible live. Love their albums, they were just horrible live.
All they're a band times. That's too great to be good.
Well, that's what they would tell you. That's what Michael Stipe would tell you. Do we have any final words? Let's go around, give our final little summation here, and then we'll get into our closing stuff.
Yeah, I want to talk about the lamp dance. I mean, we talked about practicals, but that's probably my favorite, one of my favorite parts. I think that the choreography is so great and so simple. The choreography for the whole show is just so so simple and but deep at the same time. It's not shallow
mm-hmm.
scenes. I like the lamp dance too, because I like this kind of through line with the type of art that this art rock is, which is he likes to focus on things like objects and buildings and nouns and people, places, and things. And I love that because I love working with like charged objects and things of that nature. So dancing with the light, that lampshade is just so beautiful. It's so feminine and so comforting at the same time. And it's just a lamp.
Like,
who is she?
Yeah, endowed it with some serious shit.
So light on her feet.
Yeah. All right.
I love how they're really tapped into this thing inside of us that like feels when we see things.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a nebulous way to talk about what.
No, I get it. And I think that's the way he's thinking about these things. Those aren't random objects. It wasn't like, oh, let's pull out a lamp and I'll do something with that. There was thought and energy behind it too.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like if that's a representative of your loved one, the closer you get to them, the more you glow.
Mm-hmm.
The holding of light being a pure thing of love. There's just so much that you can break down with objects.
Yeah.
And I think that they really tap into that. And they also, with just the things that they have projected in the back, and we talked about the simple way that lighting completely changes the whole situation with the way that colors, the colors being projected in the background, you know, just was like, oh, well, this is fascism. Echoes of fascism. Just the meaning behind symbols and behind objects are all, I feel like he's thinking about that. And my theatrical devised artsy fartsy hippy dippy soul is just like, Lord, this is my home.
Yeah.
I love it because this is the same thing I love about certain comedians. It's like it feels like art about humanity from an outsider's point of view.
Yeah.
And I always felt like such an outsider growing up, that like when you see art that sort of is like, no, there's got to be some sort of like a logical way to understand what's happening here, and it like misses the totality of what the actuality is. It's just like there's something so real about that, and everybody doesn't compute the whole thing in one way or another. Like everybody misses some part of it. And it's like that's the vulnerability we all have in us, and David Byrne is the one that's like putting it out there, how vulnerable he feels all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very unique way to see the world, and being unique is scary. So it takes a lot of courage to be David Byrne.
Yeah.
Takes a lot of courage to be Jay. Takes a lot of courage to be anybody in this world.
Yeah, absolutely.
But to be as loud as he is, you know, it's cool.
And I think that he was somebody who, he said he's always felt like an outsider because he was an immigrant from Scotland. He literally had to learn to change his accent as a kid because he'd get picked on and bullied and all that stuff. And all, you know, all that informs you. And, you know, he talks about it in American Utopia about watching people and watching things. And yeah, absolutely. Great point.
I would love to take a little moment to talk about sort of this time in terms of concert films, right? So it's kind of a big genre that's happening up until this point, but this is sort of the last one before the genesis of the music video. In a kind of interesting way, because this movie plays in theaters. Stop Making Sense plays in theaters, like many concert films before it, and pretty much none do after that for a while. There's a few that do, there's like a Madonna one, but nothing that's like on this level.
No.
Okay. And this one gets like third place for best film of the year at the National Board of Review. Mm-hmm. And then like won best doc. And in 2021, it was selected for preservation in the fucking whatever National Film Registry thing for the Library of Congress, because it's like culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant to our culture. But the genesis of the music video happens, MTV happens, and we sort of see the death of the concert film, but it comes back with Miley Cyrus, Bieber, which, by the way,
sold neon glow necklaces at the Miley Cyrus Best of Both Worlds tour at the Carousel in Michigan.
There you go. That's fucking sick.
I love
actually.
It. I love it. It's sick. It's hot.
There was that tour. There was the Never Say Never tour that got a movie, which is kind of also about the Bieber phenomenon. It's a really interesting talk, actually. Which is also directed by John Chu. Director of
In the Heights really?
And Crazy
Rich Asians. No way.
Yeah, and he's also directing Wicked, I believe.
Yes, that's correct.
But then, you know, you have One Direction, you have Katy Perry, like all these things have started coming back, and now we have those in theaters again, which I think is super interesting that we're getting back into it, but I don't know. Does anybody have anything they want to say about that? I just thought it was interesting.
No, I absolutely agree. And one of the things that came to my head, because I rewatched the documentary now, and my only note about the documentary now, spoof of Stop Making Sense, is that it cheats. And one of the things that's unique about this is, and I think about concert movies before that, like The Last Waltz or Led Zeppelin's The Song Remains the Same. Throughout the concert, they're cutting away and they're showing you backstage or offstage. And that's one of the things that I love about this. We don't see, you see the skin and you see the backstage, but you don't see them interacting at all.
Right.
They're not discussing anything. And I thought that was a cool choice, because it would have been easy to go stick a camera in a dressing room or, you know, try and get them, you know, after the show or something like that. But yeah, it was a huge deal. I remember my mom and dad going to see the movie, and I was like, I'm not ready for that.
I think you're so right about that. There's something about when they incorporate the behind the scenes footage in the concert movie that, well, it is interesting and it's great if you're a big, big fan. It's something that's more self-indulgent than I think David Byrne is comfortable being.
That makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. There's actually a really great concert film of Green Day called
I was just gonna bring that up.
Okay, all right.
So what's
like
it,
it's an amazing concert film. They are an amazing band. They rock the house, but they have this moment where they go and they visit like the casing of a nuclear bomb and they keep hitting it like
that's the toll, America. Covered in eyeliner. You know, with those very particular like spiky bracelets. You know, this 2005. We're talking.
I was a Green Day fan for a while.
Oh, they were my favorite band in high school.
Dookie.
Yeah, yes, American Idiot was a big deal for
me.
Yes, Bullet in a Bible is what it was called.
Interesting.
The concert film Green Day, Bullet in a Bible.
Okay,
came out 2005.
How deep that title.
Right?
It's based on another thing that they found in that war museum, which was a bullet in
hit a Bible.
You guessed it.
A what?
You don't see.
You don't see.
Yeah, so
I
they
had a band when
was...
I was a kid called Hot But Not Freezing. But then we changed our name in middle school because we were like, we've grown up, we should change it. So we became Slippery When Wet.
A Jovi ref.
A Bon Jovi reference. Yeah.
Those kids are
Well, we were a cover band, and that was one of our songs. You know.
Yeah, you were Living on a Prayer. I get it.
Wanted dead or alive.
We don't play Living on a Prayer. What else?
That's all I got. Siege, did you have anything
final? I just want to call out one moment that I couldn't do this when I was watching it with y'all, so I did it when I rewatched it last night. One minute that I watch and rewind and watch over and over again is, I think the name of the song is Live During Wartime, and the camera catches David Byrne, and he's completely bisected by the mic stand in front of him. And he's doing choreography like he's sticking his knees out and back in.
Oh, yes, like, yes.
The mic stand is bisecting him, and his choreography behind the mic stand, it makes me cheer. And I went back and watched it like three times through last night.
He's kind of like Wormy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that.
So here's a question. Obviously, this is a film, and we discussed this, and I think we all know the answer, but I want to ask sort of like as a vote. Is this theater?
Fuck yes. I think it is.
Yeah.
It absolutely is.
It made all my theater senses tingle hardcore. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Was I pulled in? Did I have an emotional experience? Was there an arc to it? Was there theatricality in the performance? And absolutely. All of it. Yeah.
There was spectacle. Like his stamina is a spectacle. Like the ability to like run... I don't know, 8 laps? What did he, like, he ran 11 laps and then came back. And how do you go back to singing without being out of breath? Like, I can just imagine me in that situation. I would be huffing and puffing for the next 2 songs.
Yeah. He doesn't ever lose. Like, he's running knees to chin at points and still on full voice. Like, it's amazing. It's amazing. Cool.
Can I do my Tom Club impression really, really quick?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, here we go.
The most controversial song in the film.
David Byrne had to leave the stage. He's like, I don't approve of this, and I will not abide.
He did not want to have
I'm going to go put on a giant suit while you play this ridiculous song.
How dare he disrespect Tina is all I have to say. Yeah. Tina is the best, and I will not tolerate it.
She's just insane. And there's a lot of great interviews with her on YouTube where she's talking about the rock industry and gender, and you can tell like she's now a tough badass 70-year-old broad that would take any of us out. She's like 5'4". She's like 5'3", 5'4". Just a tiny person, but pretty amazing.
What else do we gotta do?
Nah, I think that's it.
Thanks, Scott. I so enjoyed this film, and it's
I was
always
a little
great.
Nervous. I was like, I don't know if CJ's. I don't know if she's.
I was more nervous than you were. Trust me.
But I'm so glad you liked it. Yeah.
But I'm glad we shared it, and thank you for introducing me to it because it's gonna stick with me forever, for sure.
And go back and start listening to
like
Jodorowsky,
but in a good way.
Awesome. All right, redemption. It's just come full circle.
Cover Santa Sangre next.
No more Jodorowsky, please.
Join us next week for Holy Mountain.
What's next?
El Topo.
Should we do Spitlets?
Let's do it.
LA Spotlight.
Yeah, so this is the part of the show where we like to spotlight Los Angeles theater spitlets. LA Spotlight. Another good stinger by RTJ. Hey, CJ, you got any Los Angeles based
I do. Noor Inayat Khan, The Forgotten Spy, and one of our nominations for Theater Playwright Award at the Fringe is coming back one more time. Scott and I just interviewed Almanya, and that artist spotlight should be dropping before Saturday the 25th at the Whitefire Solo Fest in the Valley at the Whitefire Theater. And then I have One Act Somewhere, a monthly showcase of emerging talent in the theater world. The location of the showcase changes every month, with the new location announced a month in advance, and will feature shows set in the very place they're being presented. So that's Monday, February 27th at the Lincoln Beer Company, doors at 7. You can get your tickets on Broadway World. I just got mine.
Nice. I've got a couple things. Circle X Theater Company's West Coast premiere of Do You Feel Anger is playing at the Atwater Village. It's getting rave reviews. Check out Circle X online or on the social medias. Theater of Note has a 15-person play in a 48-seat theater. It's a political satire written in verse. It's
Holy
called
shit.
Yes, it's called Nimrod, a tragically unpresidential comedy. Come check it out. That's Theater of Note. Check it out at theaterofnote.org. At the Chance Theater is Ride the Cyclone. Go check that out at the Chance. I've had a few people tell me that that was worth seeing. There's Misery at the Maverick Theater. Maverick, that's at Maverick Theater. T-H-E-A-T-E-R. All the social medias. And finally, the Dry Years by the Ghost Road Theater Company is playing Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays through March 4th at the Broadwater Main Stage. It is also getting rave reviews. I have only seen the set, and the set is pretty amazing. So I'm going to go see it just because I like cool set design, if nothing else. but it's also getting good word of mouth.
Do y'all have any LA specific spotlights you want to throw out there?
I know of some things, but I'm not sure what I can speak of yet at this moment.
Got it. Okay.
I have some things.
Okay.
Awesome. Oh.
I'm the administrative director at the theater company About Productions.
Nice.
And we've got a show going up this spring, March 30th through April 8th. It's called LA Real. This is the 30th anniversary show. It first premiered back in 1993, which is crazy. This company's been around for a long time.
Wow.
And it's a one-woman show. It's from a Latina perspective about sort of the changing landscape of LA. It's really great. I can't wait to see it. Like I said, opening night, I believe, is... It's not March 30th because that's... previews. So it's going to be the following Saturday is opening night, and that runs through April 8th. And there is a panel on the Sunday matinee about archiving LA Latinx theater. Specifically about archiving that, which we've been developing for a couple years now, our own way of preserving the type of shows and productions that we do. So there'll be a panel on that, and following each show we'll have a professional actor reading student-written monologues that are part of our Young Theater Works program.
Cool.
So yeah, it's really great. I hope y'all can come out and see the show. It's cheap tickets.
Adobe Punk that they did, and it one of the same cast members that was in that was in How We Got On.
Isaac.
Yeah, yes.
Isaac Cruz. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Isaac Cruz
dude's
is in that.
Dude's blowing up, dude.
Yeah, yeah. He's busy up. All the
Amazing.
Fucking time.
I'm
yeah.
a big fan.
Very nice guy.
Yeah, and he's if a you really know, good guy, yeah.
If you want to know more, you can check out our website aboutpd.org or follow us on socials, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. That's aboutpd.
Awesome. Do y'all have anything else you want to talk about? Do you have anything else you want to shout out that's coming up? Is there anything specific?
Not quite yet, but in the next couple of weeks, I will be able to unveil some stuff.
Oh. I was going to say everybody should subscribe to Art Museum YouTubes because I was listening to The Broad today. And they literally like put up all of their events. Just all of their events are on there. You can just watch them for free.
Awesome. It's great.
That's great. They're like, they're not as bad as they were at the beginning of the pandemic. So they're actually like well created and the sound is good, so I highly recommend it.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks for joining us for Theater Theater. This was our Stop Making Sense episode. Scott, thank you for choosing it.
Thank you.
Yeah, kind of radical. Thanks for letting me do it.
Good times.
Yes.
And next week we'll be doing, and Natalie, so, and Jay, thank you for joining us.
Oh yes.
My God. Oh, our rules. Pleasure.
Yeah. We had a really good time.
We love y'all. It was really fun to get together and watch. Mm-hmm. It was really fun.
Yeah.
Like for the listeners, y'all came over to our place. We got to host. We had some lovely snacks and we had a great time. I believe there was some wine.
Yes.
And weed.
Yeah, there's mountains of weed.
Maybe.
Perhaps.
Perfectly legal. We did nothing wrong. We broke no laws.
But next week, we will be back for Andrew Lloyd Webber. We're going to be covering Evita, mm-hmm. Phantom of the Opera, and School of Rock. We've already talked about Jesus Christ Superstar before on this podcast, so you can go back and listen to that one. But we're going to be doing, we're going to talk all of them. We're going to talk
Starlight Express.
We're going to do it all. It's going to be great. And then we'll have some more episodes after that, but we'll introduce those as the Andrew Lloyd Webber miniseries goes on. Go ahead, Siege.
Did y'all have questions, comments, or compliments? You can reach out to us via email, Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. Scott?
Thank you, CJ. A big shout out to Ryan Thomas Johnson, who writes our theme song. And our theme song, though not as good as a David Byrne song, is better than your theme song.
Bitch.
Yeah. He also writes all of our stingers. He's an amazing human being. And finally, to the great award-winning playwright, Carol Churchill, who writes every single one of our episodes, and she doesn't even know it. And one day, Carol Churchill, we're going to buy you a beer.
You are all my top girls.
Thank you.
Me too?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we appreciate you guys. Please go rate, subscribe, and review. It really does help. We love you, Nat and Jay. And we'll see you guys next time.
Rare alabaster, genuine plaster, a filigreed samovar owned by the czars, a pin used by Shelley, a new Botticelli, the snipper that clipped old King Edward's cigars. Portobello Road, Portobello Road, street where the riches of ages are stowed. Anything and everything a chap can unload is sold off the barrow in Portobello Road. You'll meet all your chums at the Portobello Road.
Later, everybody.
The theater, the theater. Theater. To be or not to be. Theater, theater. The play's the thing.
Hey friends, we just wanted to add this little tag to the end of the episode as sort of a dedication to the victims of the Michigan State University shooting that just happened. Now there's been plenty of terrible mass shootings and otherwise already this year, and we wish we could dedicate every episode to something horrible, but unfortunately there's too many to count. But today we did have two guests who are alumni of Michigan State, and so I wanted to let them have a chance to sort of say a word and speak to you all. So this is Natalie and Jay, our guests for today. Hey Nat and Jay, how y'all doing?
Hey. Hi. Michigan State class of 2013.
Both of us.
I was from the theater department, and we were from the art department there. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. You hear so much about shootings, you get a little numb, you know. Like it's happening. It's been happening so often, this year even. Like it just feels so constant. The moment when it happens at a place you can actually picture, you know what the layout is, it sort of changes how it feels. And there's a rock on campus that gets repainted all the time, and right now it's just it says how many more, and that's like you hope that something like this would spur action, and yet so many like this have failed to spur action that it's hard to not feel a little disheartened.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Of course.
A lot disheartened, if I'm, if I'm being straight up.
Yeah. It's been weird, especially because, you know, I'm grateful that I didn't have to deal with that when I was there. So there's a bit of different distance, but because it's a place I'm so familiar with, there's also a lot of closeness. The thing that I would just urge everyone to do, especially if you're feeling hopeless about this, is that we can't just wait, you know, for the number to go up, because clearly the number of shootings is not changing anybody's mind. How many people get sacrificed, you know, in the name of guns. We should, it's up to us as voters to vote out politicians who receive money from gun lobbyists. It's up to us to talk to our reps and all of that, and there's hope in that. There's actionable hope in that. So and take care of your community. I wish I was there right now to be taking care of the community, but I'm all the way out here. So
one of my favorite quotes is just, you want to change the world, go home and love your family.
Yeah.
And I think family means a lot of things to a lot of people, but really what it means is, like, because a lot of the people who commit these atrocities weren't loved properly, weren't you know, taken care of properly, and they if we all just went home and loved our families, the world would be a lot better place.
Agreed. Yeah.
Here.
Thank you for giving us a chance to talk about it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And if you're someone who you know, is close to one of these tragedies, or even, you know, God forbid, falls victim to one of these tragedies or anything, you know, seek out help, seek out friends. But also, if you're a friend of someone who is in the same boat, seek them out, talk to them, because it is, it's our reality, unfortunately, right now.
Yeah, you're not alone.
Yeah.
We're all in this together.
We're all in this together.
Yeah.
So anything else y'all want to say for a final note?
I love y'all. Peace and love. I love y'all. Peace and love, everybody.
Peace and love. I love this crew right here a lot. Yeah. And I love all of our listeners a lot, too.
Same.
Take care of yourselves, everybody.